the mission. We want the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Project Censored Associate Director Andy Lee Roth is our special guest host today as well. In honor of the October 22nd National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, we look at law enforcement-related deaths, police accountability, and the increasing concerns in the U.S. about police violence. Joining us is October 22nd activist and legal advocate Karen Sari, who's long researched the number of newspaper-reported police shootings in the U.S. Diana Grant, professor of criminal justice at Sonoma State University, joins the program to address the question, why does the U.S. government fail to accurately report law enforcement-related deaths? In the second half of the program, we speak with Sonoma State University Hutchins School Professor Francisco Vasquez, who is serving on the Sonoma County Community and Local Law Enforcement Task Force. We'll close the program with a brief update from filmmaker Dylan Avery on his new project, Black and Blue, that looks at the problem of police brutality. We hope you stay with us.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We're also joined today by Associate Director of Project Censored, Andy Lee Roth. He will be with us co-hosting. We have an entire show on the October 22nd National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality. We'll be looking at law enforcement-related deaths, the issues of police accountability or lack thereof, and increasing concerns in the U.S. about police violence. And here is my co-host, Peter Phillips, to introduce our first two guests today.
We have a legal advocate, author of a study on police shootings, Karen Sari. She's been an activist with the October 22nd movement and wrote a report on how many do cops kill, which was published in Counterpunch a few years back. Also with us in studio is Diana Grant, a professor of criminology and criminal justice studies at Sonoma State University, where she teaches courses in criminal justice and public policy, white collar crime, and psychology of law. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you.
Karen, let's start with you. You did a study back almost 14 years ago now.
Yeah.
That is a foundation of a study that has been updated and is in the current Censored 2015 yearbook and also online at projectcensored.org. It's law enforcement-related deaths in the United States. But you really set a precedent. You did something new by using newspaper databases to determine how many people are being killed by officers in this country. So tell us what that was about.
Well, I had really been unaware, like an awful lot of other people, and became involved with the October 22nd Coalition and started talking to family members of people who had been killed. And I had believed the spin given in the media, but then I heard this other part of the story. And at the same time, I got on the internet. This was back in 1997, and the internet was kind of a new thing for me. And I started reading newspapers all over California, and I was finding reports of people killed by police every single day. Well, I'm a trained statistician, and the best thing for me to do with that was to make a spreadsheet. And I started doing it, and that was the birth of what became this national project where I worked with you, Peter, and we did one calendar year by using very sophisticated databases to find newspaper reports on police killings. And police kill in so many different ways, and it was tricky to learn how to find those stories.
And you ended up showing that there were several hundred
Yes.
Deaths. And how did that compare to the reports from the FBI?
Well, I think the FBI had been telling us there were, what, 300, 350 a year. And my reports showed that there were close to 700. And, I mean, I think I can pretty clearly say it must be in excess of 700, because at that time on the Internet, many newspapers weren't making it into those very sophisticated databases. I was looking over the original report last night, and we have nobody from Alaska. We have one person from Arkansas, and that's really not...
Not likely.
Not likely,
not likely at all.
So even my work, it's an undercount, I'm sure that...
Quickly tell us about the October 22nd movement. That originated back in the 90s.
Yeah, and I believe 1996 was the very first, and it was activists from around the country who felt something had to be done on this issue of police brutality. And working on police brutality town by town, county by county, really is not going to work, that it really needs to be a national movement. So these were activists who had been talking about this issue for many years, but they were from coast to coast in the middle of the country. And we did our very first protest in 1996, and it has continued to this day.
Diana Grant, let's turn to you. You're a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Sonoma State. Why isn't the government covering or telling us the truth about how many people are being killed by law enforcement? And what are the definitions of a justifiable homicide? Let's go with both those questions.
Okay. Well, to the first question, I think that it's obviously not a priority to give out the information. We collect data on everything through the Bureau of Justice Statistics and through the FBI databases. I was looking at a database the other day where if you want to know something about siblicide, you can find all the details about siblicide. But there isn't any political motivation to gather and distribute that kind of data for law enforcement-related deaths. And secondly, as to the question of what is justifiable homicide, which we know almost every death at the hands of law enforcement is decreed to be justifiable homicide, which means there's no prosecution. And when I say almost every, yes, there's some jurisdictional variations, and Karen could probably tell that I'm not a statistician, but I would say over 98%, maybe 99% of deaths at the hand of law enforcement are ruled justifiable.
I think I only know of one or two that were not.
Right. That's why I'm saying it's got to be at least 99%. And there's very few prosecutions. The Johannes Messerli case, or I should say Oscar Grant II, the BART shooting, was one of the very rare ones. And so you don't have much in the way of prosecutions. Justifiable homicide is defined by the FBI as killing by a law enforcement officer of a felon in the line of duty. And of course, most of the people who die are not people who had committed felonies or were in the process of committing felonies. And we could go into parsing whether they were violent felonies for those that were actively, for example, harming themselves or others, domestic violence or shooting at police or something. It's a very interesting definition of justifiable homicide as the killing of a felon.
Karen, when we did this study, we looked at law enforcement-related deaths, not just officers shooting someone or tasering somebody or strangling them in a chokehold, but also situations where people died, being chased by police, by being trying to swim across a lake to escape from them or something like that, where the circumstances of the pressures from the police led to their deaths. So that was a big piece of what was undercover. It wasn't a big piece, but there was certainly a significant number.
Right,
do you remember
right.
some of the kind of the numbers of how it got laid out?
I don't remember the numbers, but I've been looking at Sonoma County in the past year since the killing of Andy Lopez. And interestingly enough, four people who have died in what are called critical incidents with police, according to the police, killed themselves. Four.
If we've got several hundred deaths occurring annually in the streets, literally, and they're 99.89%, real justifiable.
Correct.
And statistically, there has to be a certain amount where officers made a mistake, where they pushed too hard. Some of these people were shot in the back, riddled with bullets. There's some really horrendous cases. And there's a whole large number of families that are winning civil suits afterwards for wrongful death.
Right.
And, you know, there's $1 million cases in Sonoma County, as well throughout the Bay Area that we've talked to and interviewed people.
Across the country.
So there has to be some percentage, 10%, 30%, or more, where officers are making a mistake.
Well, I guess I wonder about that, because the criteria seems to me to be, if the officer was in fear for his life, he's allowed to shoot to kill.
Reasonable officer standard.
I don't know if I'm not clear about that reasonable officer standard. And when the officer is afraid, I would not be afraid, but the officer is afraid, and I'm not quite getting this reasonable standard. I mean,
so 140-pound, 16-year-old child locked in a car who is shot by sheriffs doesn't sound like they had any real reason to be in fear of their lives, which was one of the cases that happened in Sonoma County. Diana, how does that get played out legally from a criminal justice perspective?
It depends on whether you're talking about prosecutors' decisions or those few cases that go to trial. I presume you mean when the cases happen, the prosecutor, and prosecutors have more discretion than anybody else in the criminal justice system, of course, to decide whether to file charges in all cases. They sit down and they discuss with the police and they discuss with their investigators and they make their decision. And if the matter goes farther, there are occasional trials, such as the Kelly Thomas case of the young man who was killed in Southern California. And three officers were put on trial, but they were not convicted of the main charges in that case. Which,
you know, when I read about those kinds of cases, it seems that when prosecutors prosecute those cases, they don't prosecute very hard. You know, unlike when they're prosecuting a so-called street criminal, it's a completely different form of prosecution.
Many people have said that, and I think you look at it on a case-by-case basis and say, yeah, I mean, that case was also very unusual because the dead man, Kelly Thomas, who did suffer from mental illness, his father is a retired sheriff's deputy, and so brought media attention to that. That was one case where media attention is what made that case, or it may never have been prosecuted.
Diana, our study looked at how police departments will, of course, circle the wagons after there's a shooting where someone dies, particularly if it's questionable. And that increased psychology of police departments under federalization, militarization of police departments, they're seeing citizens, civilians, in many cases as the potential enemy.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, the national implications in respect to Ferguson and other places.
I think that what we're seeing is that there is lots of already existing research on police culture that has always said that one of the unfortunate but not surprising corollaries of the occupation is that police tend to see the world as us versus them. Not all police, and it certainly varies with the small town officer versus the urban police. There's variations by jurisdiction and by individual, of course. But now we're seeing that the war on terror has led to increasing militarization, and I think we're seeing more of this concern about whether people can present a threat, which is very ironic to me because we are, at least theoretically, in the era of community policing.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Our associate director, Andy Lee Roth, is guest hosting with us today as well. And we're talking about the October 22nd National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, more specifically. We're into law enforcement-related deaths, police accountability, and increasing concerns in the U.S. about police violence. You can look at the current study that's in the latest Project Censored book. It's online at projectcensored.org, Law Enforcement-Related Deaths in the U.S., Justified Homicides, that's in quotes, and Their Impacts on Victims' Families by Peter Phillips, Diana Grant, and Greg Sewell. We are in conversation now with legal advocate Karen Sari and Professor Diana Grant, who teaches criminal justice at Sonoma State University. Peter?
It seems, Diana and Karen, if there's 700 law enforcement-related deaths annually, and we've been following this record now, there was a study done in 2011 that put it up over 700. We did some verifications in 2008, some specialized month sampling that also put it over several hundred that year. So we're talking in the last decade, or certainly since Karen did her study, of 7,000 to 8,000 deaths out in the country. And some of these are really significant. We actually interviewed 14 families in the San Francisco Bay Area who had lost loved ones in a law enforcement-related incident in the last decade, and we published their voices in this study. And so Andy is going to kind of take us through some of those because he was the editor for the book. Andy, let's go ahead and read some of that.
Thanks, Peter. Yes, so this is taken from the chapter Diana Grant and Greg Sewell and Peter Phillips, Law Enforcement-Related Deaths in the U.S. And these are the interviews. These are excerpts from interviews that were conducted by the Project Censored student researchers at Sonoma State University. 14 families who had lost loved ones in law enforcement incidents. I'll just read you quickly some of the kind of thumbnail sketches of the person who was the victim of the law enforcement-related death, and then a quotation from these interviews from relatives of their loved ones who were killed. One of the cases, a black male, age 19, a high school senior from Hayward, shot in the back of the head while running away from Bay Area Rapid Transit Police. No record of mental illness, no weapons present. His relative in an interview says, quote, "The police and the media just said the officer felt threatened by my son and had to shoot him. Very few newspapers changed their story or apologized when they found out that my son was shot in the back of the head." And we were obviously talking earlier about a number of these cases. You'll see that pattern repeating. Another case from these interviews, a black male age 30 from Rohnert Park with some record of prior drug use, also shot in the back while running, in this case from police, local community city police, after a car chase. No record of mental illness, no weapons present. His relative says he was running from the police, they shot him in the back, and he was murdered by the police. End of quote. Another, a black male, age 73, Ukiah. This is one of the cases that did draw some significant media attention. A long history of mental illness. The local psych unit had called the police to pick up this person to facilitate his following his medication schedule. At his apartment, he was chased by police dogs, which attacked him. He responded with a sharp object. He was shot several times in the back and the side by the police. The relative on this case says, in my opinion, he was murdered. Black male, age 30, also from Rohnert Park. Prior arrests for marijuana and passing counterfeit money, but no record of mental illness. Ran from police after a traffic stop. Shot in back, no weapons present. The relative says, he ran from the car after a stop and was shot immediately in the back. Then he was dead. He and the officer that shot him had gone to school together and played basketball together. A couple more cases. A Latino male, age 40, from San Jose, a prior felon, no history of mental illness, involved in a mistaken identity car chase by undercover narcotics officers. He ran from the car, was shot in the back. He bled to death after there was a delay in the medical response. There were no weapons, the financial settlement to the family after a civil suit. The interviewee told the student researchers at Sonoma State University, quote, "My uncle happens to drive by a stakeout and he fits the description of a Mexican guy with a mustache in a blue van. The undercover narcotics officer give chase. My uncle didn't know who they were. He ends up on a one-way street and stops his car and starts to run away. He jumps a fence and the officer shoots him in the middle of the back. They let him lay there for 11 minutes bleeding. Finally, they let the ambulance in, and he dies on the way to the hospital." And there are a number of more of these interviews that are excerpted in some detail in this chapter, but I think that gives some kind of sense of the power of this testimony. And I guess one of the questions that I would want to ask Peter, if I could, is these stories are obviously powerful, and when we hear them, they make for, I think, compelling, if disturbing, listening. And yet this aspect of the story is typically excluded from news coverage of these cases when and if those stories actually do get press coverage. Can you talk some about that as one aspect of the analysis in this chapter?
I think that was a very important piece. We did ask each of the 14 families how they felt they were treated by the media, and all of them felt that the media was biased, did not give their point of view, did not treat the individual as a human being that had died, and in many cases just kind of misrepresented. One of the primary activities of the police after a shooting is to control the family, in many cases actually take the families to the station, interview them in isolated rooms, trying to get information, negative information on the victim. And then they're waiting for reports. It comes out later that the victim had priors or this sort of thing. So it's all implied that this was in some way a bad person that needed to be, was correct in killing. So the families themselves were unanimous in agreement that the media did not cover their issues, and they were strongly had negative feelings about how they were treated by the police afterwards. So that's 14 families, and they're all saying the same thing. And these weren't, cherry-picked in any way. We just put a broadcast out for families that were willing to tell their stories. And having that number qualitatively is all saying essentially the same thing, is a solid sociological interpretation of what's going on.
And, of course, these students were trained carefully to do these interviews in a way that would generate important social scientific information, but also be sensitive to the fact that these families were...
Post-traumatic stress interviewing skills.
The other thing that the interviewers asked in the chapter talks some about is... You asked the families to talk about the victims' personalities and the memories of these people. And could you describe that a little bit, Peter, and then maybe say why that is a significant aspect of these stories?
Well, this, of course, was left out of the media, but they used the following terms were used to describe the people who had died: creative, artistic, loving, warm, compassionate, a sense of humor, delightful, good-hearted, happy, friendly, happy-go-lucky. And some of their favorite memories of the individuals were, he took me fishing when I was a child. He taught me to drive a stick shift. He could impersonate anybody. We used to walk down Strade Street together. He played basketball a lot. So those were, these are real human beings in situations, sometimes with mental illness, where being confronted by very powerful police with weapons drawn is more terrifying to them and continues that excitation. And so the procedures we're using, particularly with the mentally ill, are resulting in deaths that are unnecessary, and many of the families feel that.
And, of course, these are aspects of the victims' identities that are typically missing from the official police accounts or the news media accounts of their deaths. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored. We'll be back after this short musical break with more on officer-related deaths and deaths in jails. Stay with us.
You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we're looking just at the recent National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality. And our focus on the show today is law enforcement-related deaths, police accountability, and increasing concerns around the U.S. about police violence, the paramilitarization of the police. And we have a number of other avenues here that we're going to explore today. And here is co-host Peter Phillips to reintroduce our guest and continue the discussion.
In studio with us is Karen Sari, legal advocate, author of the study, What the Government Doesn't Want You to Know, How Many Do Cops Kill? And Diana Grant, a professor of criminology and criminal justice studies at Sonoma State University. Diana, you were talking about a reasonable officer and what that standard is, and it's a big variable. And we're seeing these hundreds and hundreds of deaths, certainly some of them very questionable, if not outright murder,
right.
But nothing happening in terms of indictments or discipline of officers. So, where do we stand with this? I mean, what does that mean?
What that means is that just like the reasonable person in any self-defense case, the reasonable officer in justifiable homicide cases is decided on a specific case-by-case basis. So it's what the prosecutor and that officer talk about that makes this decision. And in those rare times when it goes before a jury, it's what the jury believes a reasonable officer would have responded. Now, and you mentioned mental illness, because one of the things is that most of our officers, this is changing, it's fortunate, but it's not changing fast enough. Most of our officers across the nation are not trained to deal with people who have mental illness. And we know that since Reagan's deinstitutionalization in the 1970s, the criminal justice system is the dumping ground for people with mental illness. So cops we'll encounter a lot of mentally ill people, whether they're small town cops, urban cops, it's going to happen, and they don't know how to deal with them. So what's the reasonable officer supposed to do when they deal with someone who's mentally ill? Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows.
Do you have something to add to that, Karen?
Well, just on the whole reasonability issue, I was not aware that it is the prosecutor who decides, but that makes a lot of sense to me, that that's why these cases are never making it to a trial.
You know, we've been talking about law enforcement-related deaths out in the community, but there's many deaths that happen inside city and county jails across the country. In fact, the U.S. Justice Department's numbers are around 800 a year where people are dying in jail. And in Sonoma County, we've had a recent case where the newspaper is saying they're beginning an investigation because four people have died in the jail in the last month. And one of those people was Rhonda Everson, who died last weekend. And her son and her were arrested on Friday together. She was initially listed as a transient in the paper, even though she has a home and friends, and some of those friends have stepped forward and said more about what her son described had happened to her that night. And she was asking for medical attention. She said, "I feel like I'm going to die." She turned to the nurse, and the nurse said she didn't have the authority. And this continued all the way up to a nurse supervisor who basically said, "You're not getting help till Monday."
And this was in the jail.
And they're just she was going through detox. And she died that night. And there's been four other deaths in jails. There's several hundred a year now across the country. There was one case back in 2005, a man named Anthony Duarte, who put in for sick call on May 19th, didn't really see a doctor until the 26th, and it was determined that he had a burst appendicitis attack and that he almost died. So these kinds of incidences are ongoing. Certainly some of the deaths in jails across the country could be prevented under better care.
Absolutely. I mean, I've long been certain that there is intentional medical neglect in the jail, and I come to that conclusion because back when I was more active doing the research, we had people within the jails who would report to us what was going on inside. And recently I have been able to talk to a couple of people who were inmates in the jails and knew the people who have died recently and could tell me about the circumstances of their death. But it certainly appears to me to be intentional.
Or neglect.
Or neglect. And I'm not saying all the time.
And it could be intentional. But, I mean, there could be some deliberateness here. Yeah. I mean, we don't know.
No.
And when, in the case that just happened this past weekend, of course, the investigative body is a different county sheriff's department. So a lot of this is police, of course, investigating each other collaborative process.
Which brings up big questions of transparency and... Whenever you have, like, doctors investigating other doctors, police investigating other law enforcement, professors investigating professors, it's, you know, it's a little incestuous.
Andy Lee Roth here. I want to expand our scope back to kind of a national or a societal perspective for a moment. Clearly what we're talking about here with the issue of law enforcement-related deaths is a social problem in the classic sociological sense of the term. It's not a matter of individuals, but we're talking about institutions and values. We discussed a little earlier in the hour the theme of militarization, and I want to ask Peter and Diana to talk a little bit more perhaps about that theme. First of all, in their chapter in Censored 2015 on law enforcement-related deaths in the United States, they write, researchers distinguish between militarism and militarization. Militarism describes an ideology, while militarization refers to the implementation of that ideology. At the core of militarism as an ideology is the belief that the threat of force or its actual use is, in the words of one prominent scholar on the issue of militarization, quote, the most appropriate and efficacious means to solve problems. So in your chapter, Diana and Peter, you talk about militarization in terms of the equipment that local law enforcement agencies increasingly have access to, the training, and as we discussed a little bit earlier, the culture of the profession. Peter, could you talk a little bit about the equipment and training?
Well, what's called the 1033 program is surplus Army weapons, tanks, armored vehicles, assault rifles, grenade launchers being made available for very inexpensive amounts to police departments across the country, billions of dollars of equipment. We have over 18,000 incidences of SWAT team investigations ongoing just in the state annually. So we have militarized police units with advanced weapons going on, you know, literally house searches. And there's some very serious mistakes have been made, wrong addresses, and that sort of thing. So this is not a benign process. And in this process of militarization, there's a federalization as well. There's what are called fusion centers, whereby in Sonoma County, the gang task force has an FBI officer that's associated with them. And so that we see federal police, federal agents, deeply interconnected. And all of this is manifested by increased data collecting so that information that NSA is gathering on all of us is made available down to a personal level with police in the street. So they can find people, know what you are, you know, your whole history, literally. So the idea of any kind of privacy is rapidly disappearing as well. Diana?
I just have to say that it is, again, I find it so ironic. You're mentioning the increased data collection. We're getting into license plate tracking technology, all kinds of things. And yet, we don't have even adequate data collection on the circumstances of these law enforcement-related deaths. What regions are they happening in? Were the defendants carrying weapons? Were they shot in the back? Were they tasered? Did the officers have seniority? Were they new officers? Did they have training in dealing with people with mental illness? There's so many questions that could help us to work out the dimensions of the problem of law enforcement-related deaths and how to prevent it. But so we can tell you how many cruisers were bought in Omaha in 1987, probably.
Karen.
Right. And, I mean, I guess I know somebody who had a DUI recently and paid the fines, went through the program, and I understand that the police cruisers have license information. They know everybody who's committed a DUI, and they can scan license plates as they're driving down the street and pull
up the information.
Although
they make mistakes.
And there's all kinds of harassment, and It's pretty scary.
Well, yes, we also know they have these portable cell towers where they're collecting everyone's data, so the surveillance state is also a big part of this. You're tuned to the Project Censored show. We're doing an entire hour today on law enforcement-related deaths, and after this musical break, we'll be joined by Sonoma State University professor from Hutchins School, Francisco Vasquez. Please stay with us. Tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored, is also guest hosting with us today. And again, we're talking for the hour about police brutality. We're talking about law enforcement-related deaths and increasing concerns in the U.S. about police violence. And here is Peter to introduce our next guest on the program.
Our next guest is Francisco Vasquez. He's a professor of history of ideas at the Hutchins School of Liberal Studies at Sonoma State University. He has been active with the Sonoma County Community and Local Law Enforcement Task Force, which was formed a while back, over close to a year ago, after the shooting of 13-year-old Andy Lopez by a county sheriff for carrying a plastic gun through town, and certainly a serious mistake. Francisco, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Thank you very much for being here. What has the Community Local Law Enforcement Task Force been addressing, and what are some of the solutions in terms of community policing do you think are necessary?
There are 21 people in the task force, and we've been working since January of this year. We were given four tasks. One was to look at the possibility of creating a oversight committee or review committee or accountability committee. Different people prefer different names that would look at cases involving officer shootings of civilians. And another charge was to look at separating the coroner's office from the sheriff's office, the way that it used to be here in Sonoma County. And then at some point, I think in the 70s, they merged both offices. And the third charge was to look at police operations and see what could be changed to make sure or at least avoid the kinds of incidents like the shooting of Andy Lopez. And the fourth charge was to look at whatever programs were available to heal the community, given the deep pain and fear and frustration that was created by the shooting. So the 21 people task force broke into three different committees. I volunteered to be on the healing subcommittee and to look at the ways in which we can heal the community. And I felt that to deal with the first three charges requires for the people to engage in a very long-term struggle to change state, federal, union laws, regulations, in terms of how the law enforcement operates. To give you an example, I'm appalled to learn as part of this process that the sheriff is not accountable to anyone. The sheriff is elected by the people, and the Board of Supervisors does have control over his budget. But other than that, there is the sheriff is not responsible to anyone. And in order to run for sheriff, you have to go through the ranks. It reminded me of the way that the party of the institutionalized revolution in Mexico operated for 80 years, where the outgoing president would point to his successor, and then he would be the next president. And it seems that this is what happens in this situation with the sheriff. The outgoing sheriff basically blesses or anoints the upcoming sheriff, and even though the people vote for him, mostly him, very few hers, then that person becomes the next sheriff. So I chose to be in the healing subcommittee because I feel that there are other ways also to try to heal the community and to address the issues, and that is to strengthen the community. And so I personally have proposed recommendations for the creation of a Latino Student Congress to organize the Latino and other youth in terms of making them politically aware and to teach them their rights and the ways in which they can participate in the governance of their own communities. Another program that has come to the United States and actually gone all over the world is called El Sistema, and it's ways of alleviating poverty and organizing communities by getting poor kids to play in orchestras. And I know that sounds really far-fetched, but these kinds of programs do create a lot of discussion, not only about music, but about other issues that are going on in the community.
Those certainly sound like important long-term issues to address, Francisco. The U.S. Civil Rights Commission had hearings in Sonoma County 10 years ago and made some serious recommendations at that time regards to the sheriff and policing for community involvement. And that never happened. So is there some movement to talk about citizen review boards and policy planning in the community for the police?
Well, you know, that was brought up by members of the public that have been very active participants in this whole process. And the only thing that I understand on that is that the Civil Rights Commission came, did the study, left it, and then moved on. And there was no one committee or organization that assumed the responsibility to make sure that the recommendations from the Civil Rights Commission would be implemented. And I think that the shooting of Andy Lopez has made it very clear, not only to the Latino community, but to everybody here in Sonoma County, that citizens need to be vigilant of how these recommendations and procedures and operations of law enforcement are actually instituted or not. The explanation that I have heard is that this would be different because the task force was appointed by the county supervisors. Therefore, there's an implied ownership of the outcome of the task force, while there was no equivalent with the report of the Civil Rights Commission. And, of course, I think if you want to look through that in a transparent way, it's just a way of circumventing what really should have been done a long time ago.
Well, when the commission issued their report 10 years ago, since then there's been over 60 deaths police shootings or deaths in the jails, which is a pretty large number overall. And they're disproportionately people of color, particularly Latino. And the sheriff's department is certainly lacking in terms of representation of Latinos. It's like has half of what they are in the county. So is there some effort to make some changes in that area as well?
I cannot speak for the recommendations are because we're not at that stage yet. We're basically working with their own subcommittees. But we have had presentations to the entire task force on those figures and the actual breakdown. So I imagine that some recommendations are going to be moving forward. But I remember recommending to the chief of police of Santa Rosa that given the demographics that more Latinos should be hired as police officers, and the response that I got was, this was the former police chief, Sheryl Helm, and his response was, we don't need more Latino peace officers, we need good peace officers. So it's gonna take a big effort to actually get people to understand how important it is to have a representation in law enforcement. But I think the key for all of this is whether the community or a nonprofit or the social justice center or the coalition, the Justice Coalition for Andy Lopez, somebody needs to, or all of us together need to be vigilant to make sure that whatever recommendations go through, that they're actually implemented.
I think that that's a really good point, Francisco. We're going to move back to Diana from the Department of Criminal Justice at Sonoma State. To really talk about, can you put this in a broader context? Now, we have this terrible incident in Sonoma County where a 13-year-old was shot by the sheriff for walking through town with a plastic rifle. And then we have Ferguson that's happened, a police force that's lacking in diversity in almost all black city. What are the national implications for this? And, you know, we have these individual things happening. Francisco's on a task force in Sonoma County. Okay. And there's certainly a lot of unrest in Ferguson, and there's, you know, addresses in Oakland. And some places like San Jose and Davis have implemented community review boards and or ombudsmen in the department. Is there some chance or policy that this can happen nationally?
I think that we have to just see if this could happen nationally, because I think we need to have more citizen control, as we've been talking about. But I think it also has to come from internal change within the police departments themselves. And one of the ways you do that is diversify police forces. Some people would say all police are the same color, they're all blue. That may be true to some extent, but there's also, as we saw, you mentioned Ferguson. The town is mostly African American. They only have two, maybe three representatives. And I have students every day who are both people of color and people who are Caucasian who are aware of the issues. Police community relations demands that police come from the community, have relationships with them. Police are us. And so this militarization is taking us away from that. It's taking us away from community policing, and we need to have everything from more citizen oversight to better diversity in police forces to address that.
Yeah. Karen, typically, firearm training is a major part of training officers, and we're certainly hearing that it's shoot for body mass is mm-hmm. the criteria today. And research shows that it's a much graver error for a street cop to use too little force and begin developing a reputation among fellow officers as being a shaky officer to engage in excessive mm-hmm. force and be told by colleagues to calm down. So yeah. There's this culture that's ongoing. How do we deal with this?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, police are trained to shoot for body mass. People, you know, who are not familiar with this area say, why don't they shoot for the arm? Why don't they shoot for the leg? Well, they're not trained that way. They're trained to shoot where the major organs are because, according to them, it's easier to hit the large body mass. And this whole idea that the most aggressive cop is the cop who's going to go home at night, which seems to be the most important thing to cops right now, rather than serving the public.
Certainly a cultural phenomenon as well, as we've seen issues in Germany and other countries where there'll be, you know, sword-wielding, knife-wielding maniacs approaching police, and they get shot in the leg, and everyone goes home eventually. Yeah. Well, the third wheeler goes to jail. But it's definitely a part of the culture. Mm-hmm. That's Karen Sari, legal advocate, October 22nd activist. She's been our guest today. Also, Diana Grant, professor of criminal justice at Sonoma State University. We'll be back after this short musical break to hear a little bit from filmmaker Dylan Avery, who's making a new documentary film called Black and Blue. We'd also like to thank our guest, Francisco Vasquez, Sonoma State University professor at Hutchins School. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back after this brief musical break. To the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're rounding out our show today on law enforcement-related deaths. And just before we get to our brief discussion with filmmaker Dylan Avery, Professor Diana Grant wanted to add one point from the last segment.
I just wanted to say that is a culture of policing that has existed. There are signs of change. It certainly varies by jurisdiction and also by unit. The research shows most officers in law enforcement never draw their weapons during their entire careers. So that's just sort of keeping things in perspective there. What are the problem ones? What can we do about that?
Well, we're going to speak right now with filmmaker Dylan Avery. I was working on a project called Black and Blue that's supposed to be out either later this year or early next. That's going to address a whole host of these issues. And Dylan, we only have a few minutes, but we certainly wanted you to tell people about this project because, again, there is increasing concern around the United States around police violence, and it sounds like your film may be hitting at a great moment. Dylan?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great to be on. And, as you put it, you know, I'm a filmmaker currently making a documentary about police brutality and injustice. Most people know me as that guy who made Loose Change, so I'm hopefully soon going to be that guy that made Black and Blue. The conceptualization of this film started late in last year where I was still kind of teetering on the fence of should I do this or should I not do this? And as soon as I decided yes and I started looking into this, I realized that the problem is much bigger than police brutality. It's not just about these corrupt cops that go out there and do these horrible things, but the fact that there's systems set up to protect them when they do. And, you know, this powder keg going on in Ferguson right now is a prime example where you have a lot of people that have obviously felt disenfranchised and ignored for a large percentage of their lives. You know, it's, I believe, a largely black population policed by a largely white police force and government. If I'm not mistaken, if I am, I apologize. That's just what I've heard. So it's been really interesting. And I am working on this in a very interesting time. I interviewed an ex-LAPD police officer right when Michael Brown was killed, and then 3 days later he was on a plane out to Ferguson. So then when he got back, I did a follow-up interview with him. It's been a hell of a ride, and I could probably keep shooting this thing for the rest of my life because these things keep on happening. We keep having more and more incidents, but obviously at some point I'm going to have to draw the line. So I have a couple cases that are wrapped up, a couple cases that are ongoing, a couple cases that are just starting. So it's been very interesting, and I have met a large amount of people just here in the LA area who have been affected by this, and people who, you know, everybody's heard of Kelly Thomas, but nobody's heard of Michael Nida or Bobby Henning or Ignacio Ochoa. There's so many cases out there and so many stories and so much hurt and pain and sadness and anger. And I saw this Wednesday at the O22 rally, shut down this massive rally in downtown LA, and then immediately got on the phone with you. So it's very interesting. We find ourselves in very interesting times, and you know, much like loose change, I don't want to just talk about problems. I want to try and talk about solutions.
Indeed. Dylan Avery, can you tell us a little bit right now, maybe a website, if there is one, and if not, can you tell us maybe an idea when you think this project's going to be finished and how people can follow it?
Absolutely. There's an official website that's been registered, but I haven't done anything with it yet just because it's too early in the game. So the best way to keep in touch and to check out the teaser trailer, if you want, just go on Facebook/Black and Blue Film, or just search for Black and Blue on there. You'll find it. It's got like 900 likes or something. Stay in touch if you know anybody with stories to tell. You know, I'm trying to make the biggest film possible.
How can they contact you, Dylan Avery?
They can contact me right now. I have my official site, iamdylanavery.com, and failing that, there's Facebook, which I'm posting on all the time. So the best way to reach out to me for the film is probably through the official Facebook page.
Well, we'll certainly be in touch with you when the film gets closer to completion at the end of the year.
Absolutely, and I can't wait to come back.
Thanks, Dylan Avery, and thanks for your work. We're looking forward to seeing your Black and Blue project looking at police brutality. You've been tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Andy Lee Roth, our associate director, joined as a special guest co-host today. We were joined by Karen Sari, October 22nd activist and legal advocate. Also, Sonoma State University criminal justice professor Diana Grant. Also joined by Sonoma State University Hutchins School professor Francisco Vasquez. Wrap things up with Dylan Avery and his new film project, Black and Blue. Thanks to Erica Bridgman on the controls. Thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. We will see you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of the thought brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. The people organized can build the kind of future we want.
Unthinkable times, fake time, unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds. Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.